Hello, this is Anil Kumar from Back to the Bible radio broadcast. On our concluding program of the series, Journey to the Cross, we will explore what happened on Tuesday evening of the Passion Week. Let's open up the Gospels with Dr. John Neufeld as he discusses what Jesus told his disciples concerning the end times on today's lesson, The Journey Will End in Triumph.
Those of you who have given birth to children, and those of us who are your husbands, remember your contractions. But as you remember, the contractions themselves might not mean that your baby is coming right away, but it does mean it is on the way. But how would the disciples know that persecution, false prophets, wars, and worldwide evangelism would really usher in a time of the end? What evidence did they have that this was really the birth pains of the end? And sitting on the Mount of Olives overlooking the temple, Jesus patiently takes his disciples to one specific contraction, one very sharp pain, and this sharp pain will be the prophetic test case. He is speaking about something he calls the abomination that causes desolation. Let me read to you what Jesus actually said. I'm reading from Matthew 24, 15 to 21. It says, "And when you see the abomination that causes desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place," Matthew adds words, "let the reader understand." And Jesus goes on speaking, "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that your flight will not be in winter or on a Sabbath. For then there will be a great tribulation such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now. No, will never be again." The phrase abomination that causes desolation comes from the book of Daniel, found in both chapters 9 and 11. In Daniel, it's a prophetic reference to something that was fulfilled in 167 BC. Assyrian commander Antiochus erected a statue of Zeus in the temple in Jerusalem, then built an altar and sacrificed a pig on it, and with that made the practice of Judaism punishable by death. Furthermore, he gave himself the title Epiphanes, meaning he was the manifestation of God. If ever there was a picture of an Antichrist, this man Antiochus was it. Borrowing that image, which both Jesus and his disciples would have known, many Bible teachers point out that Jesus' words on the Mount of Olives were fulfilled in the year AD 70, an event that has been called the War Against the Jews. Jesus calls this period the most monstrous and savage attack against a people in human history. The devastation of Jerusalem stretched beyond Jerusalem so that the Jews literally fled to the mountains and hid in caves. The Romans were brutal, killing all with no mercy, that anyone who had time to get away had no time to go home and collect their belongings. They just ran. Josephus, the Jewish historian, says that time was a time of unprecedented suffering. He tells of savagery, wanton slaughter followed by disease, in which mothers even ate their own children to survive the siege the Romans laid on Jerusalem. Yes, there have been greater numbers of deaths in human history, but there has never been a time in history in which so high a percentage of a city's population was so thoroughly and painfully exterminated, with the few remaining enslaved, as the time of the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. As a side note, most Christians at that time, remembering this prophecy of Jesus, had already fled the city by AD 68. Now, if I understand this rightly, that Jesus is pointing to a date about 35 years in the future, then does the Olivet Discourse not look to the time of the end of the age? Well, yes, it does. I think after having given the prophetic test case, the sharp pain, as we've put it, Jesus gets back to the warnings that are approaching the time of the end. He then tells us that the days of the end will be shortened. Undoubtedly, he is expecting that the signs of birth pains he has mentioned will increase in intensity. Indeed, the famines, the earthquakes, the diseases, the persecution and false prophets and false Christs will become acute. If God did not shorten these days, no one would survive. And now then, Jesus uses a word he has not used before. It is the word tribulation. The word means great distress. If I understand Jesus rightly, he is saying that the birth pains lead to a time of suffering called the tribulation. It may be that the abomination that causes desolation, seen in the time of Antiochus in 167 BC and in the time of the Roman Emperor Titus in AD 70, is but a type or a foreshadowing of a tribulation yet to come. During this time, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the heavens. Great celestial signs will mark the troubling of the earth. And when it seems like no one can survive, it is then that the Son of Man will come in the clouds of heaven with great power and glory. It is then that the angels will be sent out with the trumpet call of God and will gather the elect from the four winds from one end of the heaven to the other. You can imagine Jesus and his disciples sitting on the Mount of Olives looking at the temple as the sun is setting on that Tuesday evening. Every eye is wide open. None of them foresaw this. They expected that Jesus ride into Jerusalem would establish him as king now. Instead, they see two things. First, they see that when he comes as ruling king, it won't be on a humble donkey the way he did 2 days earlier. It will be far more glorious than they had ever imagined. The chief priests won't be arguing with him the way they did today. Indeed, the entire earth will mourn. All the tribes of the earth will mourn. And he will come not on a donkey, but on the clouds of heaven with splendor unequaled. But they also saw that this time was further away than they had anticipated. Before this event happened, a great troubling of the earth would happen. Birth pains would lead to severe birth pains. And just in case you wonder, how do I know that God is in control of all this? Watch for the sign of the utter destruction of the temple and the devastation of the nation. That's your test case. You will be shown that everything is proceeding according to plan. But Jesus is not done. No one knows the day or the hour of my second coming, he says. It will be like the days of Noah. It will be like two men in a field. One will be taken into judgment, and one remains left in the field and is spared. And while the disciples are reeling from what they have heard, he tells them parables. One is the parable of a faithful servant who doesn't know when his master is coming, so he remains faithful, not knowing the day or the hour of his master's return. Then there's the parable of the 10 virgins waiting for the appearance of the bridegroom, 5 of who were faithful as they waited, and 5 who foolishly forgot that the bridegroom was coming at any moment. And then another parable. The parable of the talents. Faithful servants multiplied their resources, expecting the master would demand an accounting when he returned, and unfaithful ones frittered away all their master's resources. And with these parables, Jesus, knowing that he has his disciples' attention, reminds them that he will come as reigning king, gathering all the nations of humanity before his throne, welcoming some to eternal dwellings and condemning many to eternal punishment. Yes, the day will come when he separates the sheep from the goats. There might have been so many questions then. If the timing of your coming and the end of the age and when you ascend on David's throne to judge the nations is still some time away, what are we doing in Jerusalem right now? Why did you ride into Jerusalem with such fanfare 2 days ago as the crowd shouted, "Hail to the King," and waved palm branches as a sign of the coming of the Messiah? If you aren't going to do what they expected right now, but are determined to delay that until later, why are we here? And of course, they never asked the question. I think they were so overwhelmed as they stared at the temple that not one stone will be left on another. All of this would end in horrible tragedy. We do know that Jesus did tell them that after 2 days, I will be crucified in Jerusalem. And we do know that one of the 12, Judas, was so overwhelmed and so discouraged by what he heard on the Mount of Olives that he ran off to the chief priests and agreed to betray Jesus. He was done with the Jesus movement. But Jesus now set his face toward a painful and bloody cross. Stay with us as next week we again point the way to Jesus' journey to the cross.
Dr. Neufeld, this is a pretty ominous message. And I think it's one of those subjects that we either ignore or obsess over. So in the light of all that you have said, and in the light of Christ's coming, how should we respond as Christ's followers?
You're absolutely right that we either obsess or we ignore. All of us know of individuals who have set dates. I mean, it wasn't that long ago when people were saying either the year 2000 or 2001 would be the time of Christ coming. Others have set dates as well. We should never do that, but at the same time, we should learn to live expectantly. We know not the day or the hour when our Lord might return, and we should live godly lives expecting at any moment the great event of the second coming of Christ will be upon us. I think that expectancy ought to mark our ways.
I hope that today's message has benefited you as we have tried to unpack what Jesus really taught about the end times amidst some of the contradictory things we sometimes hear. May we live wisely and be prepared for Christ's coming when He judges the nations in the fullness of His glory and power. Let us take comfort in the fact that Jesus will rule this earth one day, and if we are in Christ, we will be with our great King. That concludes our first part of the series, Journey to the Cross. Join us again as we relive those last few days before and leading up to Jesus' crucifixion. Back to the Bible, leading people into a dynamic relationship with God. The Bible contains many passages about the topic of wisdom. Here are a few examples. James chapter 1 verse 5 says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him." Or how about Ecclesiastes chapter 7 verse 12 says, "For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money. And the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it." Wisdom is a critically important issue for all believers to understand and apply it. Hopefully, you have had a chance to listen to Dr. Neufeld's recent series on the subject called Skillful Living, focusing on Proverbs, known as wisdom literature. We learned all about what it means to live a wise and godly life. This great series is available on CD for our valuable listeners. To receive it, call us at 9492440070 or email at info@backtothebible.in.